Blog Talk Radio.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care and nothing is going right.
So have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up. From Los Angeles, a big L.A. welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the caregiver's caregiver on the Dave Nassani Network, coming to you through the famous worldwide blog talk radio. Yes, folks, I'm the guy who's going to help you, guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving, and we're going to do our best to help you avoid all of the obstacles that will keep you from avoiding that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Because when you don't put your mask on first, just like the airlines tell us, in the event of a loss of cabin pressure and the oxygen mask falls from the ceiling, put your mask on first before you attempt to put the mask on of your small child. And that's the reason for that silly rule, folks. They know that if you don't do that, you're going to black out and you won't be any help to anybody. Now, we're also talking about loss today and the devastating effects that it can have on us. It automatically enters into this thing called the grief process, which we will be talking about today. The only way out of the grief process, folks, is to go through it. And hopefully, we will help you do that if you happen to feel like you're stuck in it. So, I am the caregiver's caregiver. I am excited. I'm working on my third book with the same title. It's about helping caregivers to avoid burnout. And how do I know this? Because I was a caregiver. I was a caregiver for 18 years. I can't even believe it when I say that because it just seems like yesterday that my wife had a stroke and we went to the hospital and she came out of there without being able to speak. She was speech impaired for all that time. She cannot speak in sentences, paralyzed on the right side of her body. She had a rough time dealing with that, the grief process, which is what we're going to be talking about today. You know, denial, anger, depression, all of that stuff. And we've got a great guest on the line who is an expert in that area. So what caused my wife to get through this grieving period, it took her a couple of years, and she actually decided to reinvent herself and said, you know what, God is sovereign, I have faith in him. He wouldn't have allowed this to happen unless there was a good reason to happen. And so because of that, she just decided she was going to do everything that she used to do before, and she was an amazing person. She was an interior decorator, a hairdresser. She used to make dolls out of ceramic. She was a gourmet cook. She would put on dinner parties for 12 people. She was a wedding coordinator. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I don't want to bore you with it. So basically, to make a long story short, she's doing almost about everything she was doing before her stroke, which makes her even more amazing because now she's like a one-armed wallpaper hanger. Try saying that three times fast. And basically, she does everything she did before, but this time with one arm and one leg tied behind her back and, in essence, duct tape over her mouth. So let me get to our guest. This is an amazing lady. Her name is Lisa DeLong, and I can tell you about her, but I would rather have her tell you first. So let me introduce her. Let me find out which line.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Lisa.
Can you hear me? So why don't you tell the audience who you are and what you do?
Okay.
Right,
I am a registered nurse and a mother and an author and speaker on the subject of child loss and grief and bereavement. I'm also a bereavement facilitator and the co-founder of Just In Time Children's House, which is an art-based grief center in Santa Clarita. So my oldest son, Justin, was diagnosed with leukemia, the most common kind of childhood cancer, in 1990. He was 5 years old. And then he was in remission for almost 10 years when the leukemia came back very suddenly, and he died at the age of 15. And then 6 years after Justin's, my youngest son, Jacob, was also diagnosed with the same kind of non-familial, non-genetic leukemia. And he nearly died while he was on treatment. And he is now 14 years old and doing great. So we're very, very happy to have him in our everyday life. And we also have, my husband and I have been married for 30 years. And we also have two beautiful adult daughters. Thank you. Thank you. So
let me interrupt one moment here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know what non-genetic means, but what does non-familial mean?
It's basically the same thing. It's just that, yeah, well, that we know in cancer research there are some kinds of cancers that run in families, even though they cannot identify a gene yet for that trend. But in our case, I remember when Justin died, I remember turning to his oncologist and saying, tell me this can't happen again. And she said, no, it's not that kind. It's, you know, it's not that, it's not familial, and, you know, this won't happen again. Which I, in retrospect, I look back on that and I think, what a strange question to ask in the first place. And at the same time, from what I know now, I just think that science just hasn't caught up with my reality. I think that someday all cancers will be discovered as somewhat genetically linked with predispositions to every kind of cancer that we get. So, but I just think it's...
Well, how rare did they tell you that it was?
Well, the kind that Justin had was, like I said, the most common kind. To have another child with the same kind was very rare. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that statement, very rare, that phrase. This is very rare for this to happen. But I think you just don't know. You know, I really do. I think it's been well known for a long time that children, when in families, if you have one child with cancer, there's a 10% higher chance that one of your other children will also have cancer. So you do watch for it. But it isn't always the same kind. And so this was something that when Jacob, my youngest, was diagnosed, it was like a kick in the gut for us, but it was also like a kick in the gut for our medical team. They were just stunned that it had happened. So, you know, it's been a difficult journey to have to experience this, but we are doing well right now. Jacob is just a normal, healthy kid, and this whole year has been the longest stretch of months, actually, that he has not had any major colds or flus or any major setbacks at all, as far as just day-to-day health. So we're really feeling it right now, that just the blessing of being in a sense of normalcy, of health. And, you know, I'm sure you understand that, too, that feeling of, what's the next health crisis? You know, because when you have this big, major, catastrophic health event, it usually leads into so many other traumatic events as well, financially, emotionally, and then the little illnesses that can threaten our loved ones, too, once they're already vulnerable. So it's a...
So tell me, I know you're familiar with the grief process now, after the fact. What was your first reaction when all this started to happen? And looking back, you know, what part of the grief process were you in? How did you handle it? How long were you there? And so on.
Well, I remember when Justin was first diagnosed is when I would say that my awareness of even what grief felt like is when it began for me. And in nursing, you take training and study bereavement and the grief process and all those kinds of things to help our patients, you know. And we often say that grief begins at diagnosis, because that's when the loss of health begins, that you've all of a sudden, you were living in a world where everything was normal and predictable. You have a healthy child, and you have in your mind predicted all that their life is going to hold. And it's always, you know, they go to school, they win awards, they play sports, they meet their high school sweethearts, they get married. You know, you have all this, you know, planned out as a parent. And so when you have a child who, when they get that diagnosis, all of a sudden you realize that dream is potentially just a dream. So I think that for me, grief really began at diagnosis. And in those days...
And was it denial? Was that the first one that you felt?
Not, if I look back on it in the long run, like at first it was not, it was definitely denial that day of there's no way, this can't be leukemia. I remember the doctor, you know, sitting me down and saying, you know, we think Justin has leukemia. And I think, well, couldn't it be, I remember saying, couldn't it be caused by a virus, these abnormal lab results? And he said, yes, it could be.
Sure.
But we don't think that's likely, you know. And I've definitely repeated that pattern many times in my life when, you know, I get a lab result and I think, well, it's got to be this or that, you know, or virus, something explainable that's treatable. And
sure.
Yeah, so, yeah, denial is definitely an aspect of my experience.
You know, the funniest thing I've ever heard someone say when the doctor told them that they had cancer, and you know, I always try to find the funny things and the lighthearted things in tragedy, because you have to, you know, otherwise you couldn't get through it. You know, I'm always cracking jokes with my wife, you know, that other people might take the wrong way, but, you know, you need your sense of humor. Anyway, the doctor told this woman, I'm sorry, but it's cancer. And she just exploded. And she stood up and she slammed her hand on his desk. She goes, well, I didn't have cancer when I walked in here. You know, and talk about classic denial.
Yeah.
Listen, there's a caller who's been waiting. That was the one I tried to get to before. Let me see if there's anyone there, and if they have a question that we can give them a break on holding. Hold on. Caller up there.
Hello?
Hello. Yes, who's
this?
Hi,
David. This is Mark Richards.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Mark Richards. Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
You're on the line with Lisa. Do you have any questions?
Yes, Lisa.
For her?
Well, Lisa, you know, I myself had a devastating situation happen to myself, and I was listening, and you were talking about the grieving process and all that with your children, and unfortunately, I went through that process myself, and had experienced the many stages of grieving. It took many years. I was paralyzed 16 years ago, and it took me many years to get to a point of acceptance. And so have your children talked to you about that particular process, or are you just experiencing it by their emotions? Have they actually talked to you about it?
Their grief.
You know, the good thing about kids is they're a lot easier to read, in my opinion, than grown-ups, adults.
Okay.
You know, we are pretty good at masking our emotions and not letting other people see what we're really thinking. I gave a TED Talk recently. I don't know if you're familiar with TED Talks, but it's a speaking platform.
Fabulous.
Yeah. It just came out on Thursday, actually.
Really?
And
how would I find it? If I wanted to watch it, how would I find it?
You can go to
TED.com.
You can go to TED.com and you enter my name, Lisa Solis DeLong, or you can enter TEDx College of the Canyons. They were the host. TEDx College of the Canyons, and you'll be able to see me listed there as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, because I'd like to listen to that. Okay, keep going. I'm sorry.
But that's okay. But in that talk, I describe how there's a difference between personalities and the way we grieve. And I give examples of how my children presented their grief. This was after Justin died. Jessica, my oldest, was 11. Joelle was only 6 years old. And Jacob, the youngest, was just a baby. He was crawling. He was 9 months old when Justin died. And so my awareness of grief and what, how different it can be for so many people was really by observing my family. And then my husband and his grief and the way he was feeling and the way I was feeling, it was very complicated. Which
right.
I would imagine you've experienced as well with people around you.
Yes.
You know, and that makes our grief process complicated because especially if you're accustomed to being the leader in the family or the one who stays more, you know, solid, you don't want to, and especially parents, you know, you don't want to fall apart in front of your kids. You have all these family upbringing kind of teachings that you've had that, you know, we shouldn't, maybe a man shouldn't cry or a woman is a crybaby or, you know, you have all these preconceived notions about the emotions. Oh, that was very poetic, wasn't it? about, you know, about how we're supposed to emote our grief.
Right.
And so,
you know, it took me a long time to figure out exactly what I was going through and I had several people say, well, haven't you grieved yet? And I said, well, what does that mean? It took me a long time to understand exactly what it was that, like, it was almost like something I was supposed to do because of the great losses that I experienced. David, Charlene was first, went through her stroke, how long did it take you, both of you, to go through that process, do you think?
Well, I know how long it took her, a couple of years, actually, because, you know, she was dealing with a lot. She had lost everything that was near and dear to her, you know, her voice. She had me, but, you know, I seemed more like a curse at the time than a blessing because she needed someone to kind of focus all of her frustrations and her anger out on. And, you know, I love the Mills Brothers. They sang the song... You never hurt the one, you always hurt the one you love, the one you shouldn't hurt at all, you know, and I was the target, but that's okay. I didn't take it personally, you know, and I didn't think I was going through the grief process at the time, but as I look back, I was, because I was in denial a long time. Not that anything bad had happened, because obviously it had, but that it was going to be okay. You know, God was going to heal her. And we're going to get through this as just temporary. Well, you know, the weeks turned into months, the months turned into years, and the years turned into decades, and we're still dealing with this. But, you know, we're okay. We're okay.
Yeah.
Mark,
let me
go ahead.
I was going to say, I didn't know, because it took me, well, when I was first paralyzed, this was actually May 2nd of 98. I woke up in the morning, and I couldn't use my legs. And it's a long story. I have it on a website of mine, but it's a long story. But basically, it took me many months to figure out if they were kidding, almost like that. I was in the hospital for May 2nd. I was in the hospital till October when I finally left and went home. But the entire time I was in the hospital, I kept thinking, you know, am I one day going to wake up and it's just going to happen? Because I wasn't in an accident. It was a medical overdose situation, and it was very unusual. And so it took me a long time before I started thinking, okay, this is permanent. How do I deal with it? And so that's why I was asking the question about how long it took you, because, and everyone's different, of course, but it took me a long time to get to a point where I was saying, okay, this is real, you know, and what do I do about it? And I've lost, oh, my God, I've lost so much. I can't walk anymore. And, you know, I'm still at the point where I've accepted it, and I've moved on. But it took a long time to get to the point of
how many years would you say?
About all these, oh, God, probably 5 or 6 years. I mean, it took me a long time to get to a point where people were saying, haven't you grieved? And I could finally say, yes, I have. And I've overcome that, and I'm moving on. Does that sound familiar, Lisa?
Yes, very. And, you know, while I have not experienced physical paralysis, I would have to say that it's very much like the death of a child. You do feel paralyzed for a period of time in your own life, you know, in your own surroundings, in your own life. You feel I have heard it many times from my parents and from myself, too, that you're kind of in a fog for a long time. You're detached from your from your reality. And that detachment is, you know, it's easy to look at that as denial, but it's also so necessary to have that period of detachment where you are really looking for, at your life from the outside in, where you're right. All of a sudden you're taking inventory of everything that used to be and realigning it, almost putting it in a different warehouse of, well, this is what is now. And we in grief work, we talk about how in the grief process, you create a new normal. You start to understand what your new normal is. Yes. And what a process that is. So I'm always hesitant to attach my own thinking too much to stages when it comes to the grief process. Like you were saying, Mark, you were going through a process that was
right.
Natural and organic. It came out from your life and from your experience. And people were saying, well, haven't you grieved? Well, exactly. When you said, you know, well, what does that mean?
Exactly.
That's like my life motto. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've said that. Well, about many, many things in life. Like, well, what does that mean? Now, you hear people say very cliche things, especially when you've
right.
been in, you know, traumatic life you had. I very often will say, well, what does that mean? You know, even
it's
if it's, what does that mean
said,
to
are
you?
Are you in stage four? Are you in stage four of the grieving process yet? Or have you reached stage
yeah.
five?
Yeah, and as we know, grief is a very individual, personalized event. I mean, it's more than an event. It's a process. And so what I've dealt with as a bereaved mother is after Justin died, adjusting to my new normal over time, thankfully I had three other children and my husband, and so I had loving people around me, and we were all doing this together. And as ugly as that got sometimes, we still had each other to have some kind of understanding of what our new reality was. But I think that the key for most people who are experiencing devastating losses is to understand that it is a process. Because
yes.
I think Americans especially, we like a checklist. We want to go through stage one, and then we want to move on
That's
to
right.
stage two, and three and four and five, and if there's, then please don't throw in a seven or an eight, because, you know what I mean?
And by the way, please put it in the microwave to go.
Yeah,
Mark,
exactly.
Thank you for your call and your question.
You bet.
I've got other callers I've got to get to, and can you hear me, caller?
Hello, it's me.
Hi. Ooh.
Hi, this is Mona, and I'm just calling to say hi to Lisa.
Mona.
Hi, Mona.
Yes.
Oh, I love
what
Mona.
Buddy. And I didn't realize
that I
was going to listen
too,
myself,
but it's
too.
It's a different Mona. Do you have a question,
so
Mona, or are you just listening?
No, I'm just listening, too.
But
okay,
I would like to
interject.
I would like, wait
yes.
a second. Are you there, David? Can you leave Mona on?
Say that again? Yeah, I'll leave
can
her
you leave
on.
Mona
go ahead.
On okay. Because Mona is really pivotal in my life as a caregiver. And we had talked about, you know, the needs of caregivers and caregiver burnout. Mona is a nurse who and a friend. Her daughter ran track for my husband, Dave, at Canyon High School. And Mona was a direct caregiver to Jacob when he was very, very sick. And she would come to my house in the middle of the night. I remember on more than one occasion when Dave and I needed help. And I remember I had the flu and Jacob had the flu. And Mona just got in her car, came right over, and went with Dave and Jacob to the emergency room at Children's while I recovered at home. And, you know, the key thing about people like Mona in our lives is that, you know, when we talk about caregiver burnout and how the needs of our loved one is 24/7 for us who live with that person. But people like Mona are, you know, they're a godsend. So, Mona, you're a godsend, and I just want you to know that. I know I've said it to you before, but I miss you.
Me too. You guys are always in my heart, and I'm always still here for you. You know that.
I know. But I just love hearing your voice, and so we just have so many fond memories. And then don't forget our USC day, which is also Mona's in my book a couple of times. And there's a story in there about when Mona and I went to the Natural History Museum to take Jacob for the first time. He was able to go back into public after his immune system got stronger. And it turned out to be, it started out as a really rough day when Jacob threw up in the car and surprised us. And Mona and I, you know, went into action and cleaned him up and stopped in the bookstore at USC and got him some sweats and a T-shirt to just add a necessity. And that day turned into us being able to meet with Pete Carroll right in his office. It's a great story, and Mona was a big part of that story, and it's one of my favorite memories with my friend. And so you just never know what a day is going to bring, and just like you don't know what a call is going to bring.
Well, thank you, Mona, and for all the other Monas in the world who are behind the caregivers who couldn't do it without you.
Yes, amen to that. Thank you, Mona.
So I'm learning there are some people who are calling in just to listen. If you want to speak, I think you push number one, and that will cue me that you want to speak. Otherwise, I will not bother you. So let's move on to anger, Lisa. Was there a point that you were angry at somebody after you went through your denial?
Well, because I've had many losses, but you know, over time, I didn't feel angry when Justin was first diagnosed. I remember really thinking about this, like, why don't I feel angry? And it kind of takes me back to what Mark just said. Like, he didn't, like, people would say, well, aren't you feeling this and aren't you feeling that? And I think when you're living it, you don't really know what you're experiencing. You're just getting done what needs to get done. In my case, I did not feel anger at God or toward anyone when Justin was first diagnosed. I had been a nurse for several years by then, and I had seen firsthand the devastating losses that other people had experienced, including children, accidents and gunshot wounds and stabbings and all kinds of things that I thought, wow, you know, and illness, all kinds of and weird accidents that you think, why would that happen, you know? And then that whole idea of bad things happening to good people was something I had seen dealt with quite a lot at that point in my life. And so when Justin was diagnosed, I remember saying, I never got to the point of why me. It was always, well, why not me? You know, look, it happens. This is the way the planet rolls. And but it wasn't until Jacob was diagnosed. When Jacob was diagnosed, I was so shocked that I had to deal with this again. And then when he went through he became very, very ill about 6 months into treatment and developed a condition called veno-obstructive disease. And the doctor took us into the conference room and said that we needed to prepare ourselves, that if things didn't turn around for Jacob, that he would be not likely survive. And I remember that's when I got mad. And I share this story also in my TED Talk and also in my book, that I remember walking down the hall at Children's Hospital and looking out a window where I could see the Hollywood sign and Sunset Boulevard, and I just raised my fist to God, and I just said, picking on my boys as loud as I could, and I just sobbed. And at that point, I felt a sense of peace pour over me like I had never experienced before, and it was just like water pouring over the top of my head, and I knew that Jacob would live. And that was a very pivotal point in my life where that feeling of surrender, that's what peace, what it comes down to when you are in a state of peace, is that you're beyond anger. And really that's when the acceptance begins. And that was really facilitated by having that spiritual experience of justice. And I started paying attention to the spiritual messages that I had started to receive, especially when Justin was ill. I think sometimes we dismiss those experiences as though they don't matter, but I really, for me, they matter more than anything else in my experience, to pay attention to, oh gosh, you know, when you just know something, those internal quiet messages that you get, and you just know, you know. So that was very helpful to me. And so anger has never been a big part of my personal experience. It has been probably more for Dave at times, especially right after Justin died and he had to return to work, and he was with a lot of kids that Justin was friends with, and they were all of Justin's friends were going into high school that the summer that Justin died, and so Dave got a lot of them as students, and you know, just the frustration he felt with not being, you know, having them there and not Justin, and especially when he had really difficult, challenging students, and that feeling of this, you know, why would this kid be here who's so difficult, and my son is gone, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it really depends on the person and the circumstances that you live in for that sense of anger to really float to the surface.
Yeah.
But it's
and
very,
my wife
very
displayed
common.
A lot of anger,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
she, you know, when you take away a person's ability to communicate, you know, that's what separates them from the animals. The language in our brain that God has given us, when that's gone and you're angry, you know, you have nothing to do but scream, you know, and the rage, you know, and I remember for days, maybe even weeks, you know, Charlene's only language was just screaming at the top of her lungs because she was so frustrated, all this pent-up emotion, you know, just needed to vent, you know, things that I would do that would upset her, you know. You know, she couldn't drive anymore, and, you know, of course it was my fault, you know, I took away the car because, you know, somebody had to take it away, but it's very difficult to drive when your right side is paralyzed, and then, you know, we lived in a two-story house in Burbank, and I had a business in Castaic, and either the business was suffering or my wife was suffering because of the 35 mile commute. So
mm-hmm.
I decided, you know, we had to move because I can't do it anymore. And she loved that house. I mean, that was the house we were going to bury her in the backyard, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
you know, we had to move her kicking and screaming, you know. She did not want to move. And she especially didn't want to move to Castaic because, in her mm-hmm. opinion, only, you know, cows live there, because in those days
mm-hmm.
maybe cows did live there. But it has grown a lot since then.
Mm-hmm.
So she's lost a lot. We had a small granddaughter at the time who just adored her. And now, you know, she noticed that there was something strange about Grandma, and so she pulled back. So she lost her granddaughter. She lost everything. And anger was a big part of her communication in those days. And I'm sure a lot of the people calling have their own stories. I remember there was a girl in our church whose husband died unexpectedly, and they were engaged to be married, and they were
mm-hmm.
just a couple of lovebirds, and for, I don't remember the reason, but he just basically dropped dead, and she's still dealing with it, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and as a Dr. Laura type of a counselor, which I am, you know, after a year or two, I remember telling her, you know, you need to move on, you know, you need to let go. You know, she still has this picture on Facebook and this and that. And she just lashed out at me and saying, listen, everybody deals with grief differently. You know, there's no set time
mm-hmm.
frame. And I mean, I learned a lesson.
mm-hmm.
You know, she's not ready.
I've heard that very often. Yeah, and the thing is, when you are that bereaved, I think it's very different when you're still dealing with a living person who at least gives you the opportunity to touch them physically, to care for them. I've heard this and seen it with many, many parents who've had children who were either born with or developed long-term chronic illnesses where they were completely
uh-huh.
dependent on the parent. And they grieve more intensely than most parents who have had healthy children, fully functioning children. And it's an interesting phenomenon I've experienced, I've seen it, and I think it's, as humans, we are designed to care for each other. And as long as that person is still in physical form, you can care for them. In grief work, we often say that grief is love with no place to go. When the person whose body is altered, you can still give them your love. when that person dies, like this woman and her husband who died so suddenly, or fiance, it's like all that love and passion and future and all that dream was completely severed. And all that love has to find a new way to exist. It doesn't have nowhere to go. And so that's why I talk about grief and have opened Just in Time Children's House, a grief center here in Santa Clarita for children and families, children and adults.
Tell us about
what
that.
I've discovered. It's just we all need a place to express our grief over time. And the idea that, you know, that a child, let's say, you know, like my children after Justin died, that, you know, if they're emoting something, some frustration about not living with their brother, and it's been a year or 2 years, I learned early on, and thankfully I had this enough awareness in me as a trained nurse, that you let people emote what they need to emote. They need to feel, all of us need to feel what we need to feel at the core of our heart. And express it out. And if that's anger that pops up and it helps to throw a vase or dirt clods on a mountain or, in one of the exercises
we do.
One of the exercises we do is with kids and adults, we'll take raw eggs, a whole basket full of them, and we'll write words on them, you know, words that we know, whether it's I miss you, I love you, I'm mad, I'm angry, I hate that you're not here. Whatever you want to write, you write it on that egg, and then you go to the biggest tree at the camp that we do this at, and we just chuck the eggs as hard as we can at this tree, and just the eggs explode, and there's this sense of satisfaction that we've released an emotion. And by doing that, you can let some of that go. And so when you say to someone, you know, it's time for you to let go, you will almost always get an angry response because exactly what you said the woman told you is, you know, you don't know. And so what I suggest people say to anyone who's grieving at any point along the line, whether it's been a year or a month or 10 years, is the idea of just tell me more about what you're experiencing right now, you know, and not try to squash it, because that person is crying out to talk about their deceased loved one, and all they have left is words and memories. And after a while, people get tired of hearing it. But very often when they do start to say, it's just you want to hear your son's name again, to have someone say, oh, I miss Justin too, just to hear his name or Andrew or whatever the person's name is. You know, and it's a helpful thing if a listener can allow that grieving person just to vent. We figure it all out on our own. That grief work is very internal, and grief really has its own intelligence. So that if we let ourselves process it, feel it, you know, and commune with others, that's the other aspect of doing grief in a healthy way, is communing with other people in a safe, non-judgmental environment where we don't hear advice, we just get to vent and hear other people's stuff, you know. And then so that's why I started Just in Time, because I really believe that children especially need opportunities to do that for life, not just for weeks or months after someone died, but for the rest of their life. And for most adults, we need that too.
Yes, and let me ask you something else. But first, I want to just remind everybody the phone number, if you'd like to call in. It's 213-943-3630, and hit the number 1, and that'll let me know that you want to talk. Otherwise, I'll just see you and assume you just want to listen. I heard, Lisa, you have something called, and this sounded a little morbid to me, but I'm sure you can explain, the Death Cafe.
Yeah, it's Death Cafe is a...
it isn't it where
is
you go to die, right?
No, and it's not goth,
oh, good,
you know,
good.
It's not like you have to wear black fingernail polish or anything. what a Death Cafe
we don't send depressed people there.
Well, if you're depressed...
Or maybe we do send depressed people there.
Well, what it is a global movement that was started in London by a man named John Underwood, And he had a gathering of friends over one day, and they talked about death. They wanted to talk about either what they were thinking about death, or maybe they had their own concerns, especially as his friends were aging, and these conversations were starting to come up. But anyway, he noticed that, you know, just like here in America, in the UK, it was a taboo subject among, you know, socially. So he invited his friends over, and they talked and had cake at the end of it all, because that's a very British thing to do, to have your tea and cake. And everybody enjoyed it so much that they did it again, and pretty soon other people were hosting death cafes. And so he just created a model, basically, that's considered a social franchise to help people start death cafes all over the world, and now there are hundreds of them popping up globally. So, yeah. And
so is there one locally in the Santa Clarita area?
Yes, there is, and I host it. So I host Death Cafe Santa Clarita with my friend Shaneen, and Shaneen is the co-founder of Just in Time Children's House as well. And she and I invite people to our gathering. The next one is on May 21st in Newhall. And if you'd like information about that, the best thing to do would be to find us on Death Cafe Santa Clarita on Facebook. Yeah, either that, or you can look on our website, justintimechildrenshouse.org, and there is a link to Death Cafe Santa Clarita on our website as well. But it's I'm telling you, it's an amazing experience. The first one we hosted here, actually at my house, and Shaneen and I, you know, invited people, and we had the most incredible turnout of, we keep it limited to 10 people, so it's always very small, but we had such a diverse group of ages and spiritual backgrounds, religious backgrounds, walks of life. We had a shaman, a professor of philosophy. We had an animator, a brand new social worker who didn't have very much grief experience and wanted to know more professionally how to handle it, you know, with others. And another parent who'd lost a child. So it created this forum, and basically the premise is that you sit down and you talk freely without any judgment or agenda. And so our role for Shaneen and I as facilitators or as hosts, actually not really facilitators, but as hostesses, we just create a safe space, and by showing up you agree that you can talk freely and other people can talk freely without ever hearing the response. You'll never hear. We really strongly recommend that people do not respond with, well, you should, you know, think this or that, or you should try this or that. It's just listening and sharing. Well, this worked for you. This works for me. This is what I think. This is what you think. And so far, we've hosted these now for almost a year, and it's been amazing. You get people in different, sometimes in fresh grief even, or they've been a little farther out and they can help somebody who's there. The idea is that it's not a grief support group, but rather more like a thought potluck is how I like to think of it. And so it's got a different feel than a support group. And I highly recommend that everybody attend a death cafe at least once to see what it is and how
wonderful it feels. You've got me curious. I think I will,
yeah.
I will go.
Yeah, great.
Let's switch gears a little. I want to ask, what do you do on a daily basis to stay healthy mentally, physically, and spiritually?
That's a good question.
You sound pretty you sound like you've got your head on pretty good based on what you've gone through. Or in spite of what have gone through, I should say.
Exactly. most days I have my head on pretty straight. But like everyone, you know, when you're in the throes of your own life, there are days when it's tougher, you know, to feel inspiration even to get out of bed, you know. And I think for those of us who are caregivers, primarily who have a lot of experience as caregivers like yourself, you quickly realize how demanding that can be. For me, when I get up in the morning, I try to go outside as soon as possible and get fresh air. The first thing I'll do is, you know, open the door or window or go outside physically and just take a big, deep breath and open my arms and just thank God that I'm here and ask for guidance and joy for the day. And I very often in the morning will take, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes to do a quiet meditation and pray. And I have a little journal that I've been writing in for years and years and years. I actually started writing in a journal when I was a newlywed. And that helps me get my day started. There are different books that I read and have read over time that help me. If I'm, like, my thoughts are too scattered, I've had several, there's so many good daily devotionals and those kinds of things, and also spiritual books that are kind of maybe not on the typical reading list, but have been very helpful to me. I find it helpful just to think in terms of bigger than my own life. I also like to read memoir. I like to read about other people's lives because then that gives me perspective on my own. So I usually start my day out that way, and then I walk. I try to walk every day. I don't belong to a gym or any kind of fitness classes, because I don't like being indoors. So I find it very spiritually nourishing and refreshing as a caregiver in daily life to get outside. And there were many, 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 many weeks and months at Children's Hospital Los Angeles with my boys and at City of Hope where when you're stuck in that environment of being indoors and also having worked in hospitals, there's it feels like just energy being sucked out of you when you're in that environment so much.
Yeah.
And right? Yeah. So getting outside is key for me. And I don't need anything. I just need my legs, which I am thankful and privileged to have. And I thank God for my legs every day. I honestly do. Yeah. And to get outside and hear a bird chirp, and I love birds, so I have a bird feeder outside, and I very often will just take 5 minutes to just watch them. And so those are things that I
especially am thankful that I can still walk because I had broken my ankle. I was in a bicycle accident. I loved a bicycle. And this car hit me, and I went flying through the air and landed on their windshield, cracked it, and bounced onto the asphalt. And that was a year and a half ago, and I'm still limping, and I'm still waiting for it to stop hurting. I've had a surgery and everything. There's nothing more they can do. But let's ask the next question. You know, most of our listeners are caregivers trying to stay away from burnout. What can caregivers glean from your new book, Blood Brothers?
Well, in Blood Brothers, I really tried to be as honest as I could about the real life experience of having two sons with cancer and dealing with grief and raising a family. And I think it's helpful for us as caregivers to be really honest with ourselves, especially for women. We tend to think that there's something noble about serving others. And, of course, it is a great gift to be able to serve others. But some of us do it to the point where I call a chronic caregiver, where you just can't stop giving. And when you recognize about yourself is usually about the time, or when I recognize it in someone else is when I hear a person say, "I do so much for others and I don't get anything in return." And that's a big red flag for me that person doesn't love themselves enough.
Or I do so much for others and I don't do anything for myself.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Also...
And it's easy to fall into that.
Oh, yeah. Because by nature, caregivers are very selfless and giving and generous and sacrificial. And it just comes natural. I mean, that's what they do. And yet, you know, this wasn't on their resume. They were involuntarily inducted into being a caregiver when, you know, their parents came down with Alzheimer's or their wife had a stroke or their son came down with leukemia or whatever, you know. So none of them are prepared to do what it calls for. You know, like the airline industry says, you know, if in the event of a loss of cabin pressure, the mask will fall down, put your mask on first before you attempt to help your child with their mask, you know. And that's basically it. You know, when Charlene was, when she was going through her rehabilitation and her therapy and this and that, her mother came to live with us. And her mother is one of those self-sacrificing, that she had cared for her parents, had hospital beds in the house. You know, the Social Security was paying them to take care of her parents. And then her husband's parents, I mean, it was like a convalescent home. And they were getting great care, getting great food, and they were taking great care of them. And they were living forever because of all that great care. If they were in a convalescent home, you know, they wouldn't have lasted very long. But the point of what I'm saying is, whenever Charlene was, you know, wanted something, because, you know, she wanted to be around the kitchen because she's a gourmet cook, and she would try to cook her own food, and her mother was, oh, no, honey, let me get that for you. You know, or she'd be reaching for something in the cabinet, and she's, no, let me get that. Whereas I would say, you know, now push just a little higher. Come on, stand on your toes. You can make it. You're almost there, you know. And her mother thought I was cruel for doing that. But the occupational therapist says, you know, that's what they want to see, because otherwise you're going to make them dependent instead of independent. And right now, Charlene is one of the most independent people that I know. You know, I was just away on a 3-day seminar, and I says, you want me to have someone come and stay with you? She says, nah, I can stay by myself, you know. She's got everything, you know, just make sure the refrigerator's full and you know, I have my iPad, I'm fine. So, well, we're running out of time, Lisa. Is there anything that I have not covered that you wanted to mention, or some upcoming events, perhaps?
Yes. Well, at some time, we are now hosting a bereavement group. It's our general grief group on Monday evenings at 7 o'clock in Newhall. It's for adults and for children. We run our groups separately, and we are an art-based grief center, so we always have some way for our kids to express their feelings in an art form, and that's really fun and beautiful. And very often, if we have a small group, we'll engage the adults in that project as well. It's usually something very simple, and it's really wonderful to see what comes out of us when we have even just a crayon in our hand.
How often is that?
That's every Monday evening at 7 o'clock in Newhall. And if you'd like the address, you can contact us on our website, or you can email me at lisasolistalong@gmail.com. And
your website.
And you can also find lisasolistalong@gmail.com. And that's also my website.
SolisDelong.com. LisaSolisDelong.com. Got that, everybody?
Uh-huh. And then also you can reach us at justintimechildrenshouse.org.
And that's all one word, Justin.
All one
your
word.
Son's name.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, I knew a kid named Justin one time, and you know what his last name was? Case. That's what his parents did to him. Just in case.
It's a fun name to play around with. But so those are Monday nights. And then we have our next Death Cafe on May 21st in the evening, also in Newhall. And this Saturday coming up, I'm the race starter for the Amgen Tour Bike Stage 7, start of the stage of the Amgen Tour race here in Santa Clarita. And that's the festivities for that start at 10 a.m. And I'm looking forward to that. So if anyone wants to come out and find out more about Just in Time, or to meet me, or to meet Shaunine, we're going to be there. And I'm happy to talk with you about Just in Time and Death Cafe and all the things that are going on. And, good things are happening. We're brand new, so this is all a new journey.
Well, this show is brand new, so it's a good match. I met a very special person at the seminar I was at, Sandra Champlain, and I think she's going to be my guest next week. She wrote a book, We Don't Die, A Skeptic's Discovery of Life After Death, and she actually has a CD on the grief process that she said that she would send to anyone who wants it free. So go to my website and request it, and you just have to pay for the shipping, which I think is $5 or $6. the great little CD. It covers all of the processes in the grief process. And my website is davenass.com. And just register there and say, I would like the CD, and I'll forward that on to Sandra. And we look forward to hearing from everybody next week. Don't be shy. Call in with your questions. And Lisa, I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us. It was a joy and a delight. You're a wonderful speaker and an amazing person, and I don't know how you do everything you do.
Well, you know, we have 24 hours, so every day. I have great people around me. That's how I get it done.
And all she can say is, well, you know.
Well, you know.
Okay.
Well,
God bless everyone.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for calling in and tuning in. And we'll see you next week at 3:30, same time, same channel.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care, and nothing is going right, close your eyes and think of me, and soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night. Oh yeah, yeah. You just call out my name and you know.
See you again.